You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and RadioCafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. On today's program, we're going to hear about childhood trauma. Not a happy subject, but our guest, Dr. Bruce Perry, brings so much insight to this work that it's actually quite hopeful and really interesting. Stay with us. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Elevating interest and opportunities in STEM, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And the Radio Cafe thanks the Lanl Foundation for their sponsorship of this show. Our guest today is Dr. Bruce Perry. He's a psychiatrist, currently senior fellow at the Child Trauma Academy in Houston, Texas. He's a professor of medicine, a clinical researcher, a consultant on children's mental health, and author of several books, including The Boy Who Was Raised as a Dog and Other Stories from a Child Psychiatrist's Notebook, What Traumatized Children Can Teach Us About Loss, Love, and Healing. I read this book a few days ago, and I highly recommend it to anybody who's had children, works with children, or had a childhood. It's full of incredible stories and brain science, but all told in a way that is comprehensible to ordinary readers. So thank you, Dr. Perry, and co-author journalist Maya Salovitz. Dr. Perry will be in Santa Fe this September for a symposium at Santa Fe Community College, sponsored by the Santa Fe Community College Early Childhood Center and Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation. Welcome, Dr. Perry, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the opportunity.
So the field of childhood trauma studies, traumatology, is relatively recent. During your medical studies in the 1970s and 80s, it was thought that children were resilient, and while adults got PTSD diagnoses, children didn't. Talk about that, this huge blind spot.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you bring that up, because we're kind of seeing aspects of that playing out in the way people are thinking about what's happening to these children who are being separated from their parents in the midst of all this immigration issue. That there are people who really understand that that's a significant experience, a significant negative experience for a child, but there's other people that kind of just blow that off. And I think we're living in a time when we know a lot about development. We know a lot about how experiences, good and bad, influence the developing child. But that knowledge has not been widely disseminated and is not what you'd consider sort of common knowledge. And 20 years ago, or actually 30 years ago, when I started doing this stuff, it was even worse. You know, even the professional communities that I was active in really didn't think much about the impact of traumatic experiences on the developing child. The odd thing is that if you sat down with anybody and you said, here's a child that we are working with who had a parent struggle with substance abuse when they were an infant and neglected them, and then they ended up in foster care, and they were abused by somebody in foster care, and then they ended up in another home. Do you think that that's going to have any impact on the child? Almost everybody would say, of course. But that was about as far as it went. People didn't think much beyond what kind of impact, what do you do about the impact, how do you change the systems? And we were really kind of stuck in a way of thinking about emotional and social and behavioral problems through the lens of the traditional mental health model, that we have to go down the list and check the symptoms. And if they meet certain criteria, and then they have this diagnosis, and then we treat them based on that. And it was unfortunate, but really, I think in the last 30 years, there's been an emergence of an appreciation about these things, even though it really hasn't fully impacted the mental health community yet.
Talk about the scope of the problem of abused and neglected children. How extensive is that in this country?
Well, abuse and neglect is a pretty significant problem in our culture. You know, we know that literally hundreds of thousands of children each year are impacted by some form of abuse or neglect. Now, one of the things that we're learning more and more about is that there are other forms of developmental adversity that may not reach the level of a clearly obvious trauma that have equal impact on the developing child. So, for example, a child who lives in an environment where there's all kinds of chaos and unpredictability about housing or even the food unavailability or insecurity that can come from poverty. All of those things can also impact the developing child and result in some of the same physical, social, and emotional problems that we see with a more conventional abuse-like trauma. And so if you take all of these adversities into consideration, you know, you're talking 25, 30, maybe even 40% of the population has some form of developmental insult or challenge that will influence how they grow up. So it's widespread. It's across the socioeconomic spectrum. It reaches almost every community, urban, suburban, rural. And the reality is, I don't think that there's a family I can think of that I've ever known or ever worked with or ever been in that has not had somebody impacted by developmental trauma in one way or another.
And when you say developmental trauma, it's very literal. And one of the big insights that your work brings to the field is that the problems that children are suffering, whether they be seeing domestic violence or being the victim of, I mean, there's so many, as you've just talked about, those experiences literally affect the brain. They affect the physical brain. Talk more about that.
Sure. Just to back that up a little bit, your brain, everybody's brain is what we would call dynamic. It's always changing. It's always being modified in response to the experiences that you're having. So if you go to a movie today and you sit in the movie and you watch the movie, some part of your brain will change. And that's because of the way our brains work. They're very malleable. They're changeable. They're designed to be changeable so that we can adapt to the different environments we're in. Now, with that said, what we know is that if you have extreme stress and distress, unpredictability, chaos, threat, things like that in your life, the systems in your brain that are involved in the stress response are going to be activated and then altered. Usually they're altered in a way that helps you adapt to the immediate threat. But once that immediate threat is over, you end up having maladaptive responses to non-threatening experiences. So if you have extreme threat or prolonged threat, your brain basically says, wow, I'm in a threatening world and I need to make adaptations and changes so that I'm ready for that next big threat. And so you'll have children who go to school and their brain will be in this state of fear, even though there's nothing to be afraid of at school. But if you are in that state of fear, your brain is going to pay much less attention to the words that the teacher is speaking to teach you something and more attention to the unpredictable sounds of the street or the nonverbal cues of your classmates. And so you don't learn to read as quickly. You don't focus on math. You don't learn history or geography, but you develop what we would call street smarts. And so, you know, one of the consequences of the developmental trauma that children have is that they will have a higher probability of surviving their chaotic, threatening environment, but they'll have a higher probability of failing in the world's environment. You know, they won't do well in school. They won't do well with relationships. They won't do well in sports and work and after school programs. They'll be socially immature. They'll be inattentive and dysregulated. They'll be quick to anger and act before they think. And this, again, all of those characteristics are highly adaptive in an environment where there's threat and unpredictability, but they're highly maladaptive in a classroom, for example.
One of the things that I thought was so interesting about your book is that when professionals, mental health professionals, are evaluating children, they tend to rely on this thing called the DSM, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, which has gone through many incarnations, but it's basically a list of symptoms which doesn't give the which doesn't give the evaluators essentially access to the deeper reality of what's going on, why those symptoms. And so you can assign a bunch of symptoms to 10 different children who have similar symptoms, but the underlying reasons might be extremely different. And part of your methodology is to really do that differently. Talk about that.
Yes, the traditional mental health perspective uses the DSM, this kind of a guidebook for understanding emotional behavioral symptoms. And, you know, it's an interesting and challenging aspect of mental health is that we're, in relation to other domains in medicine, we're kind of behind in our ability to connect physiology with pathology. So if you, for example, are on the street and all of a sudden you develop chest pain and you go into the doctor's office, they will do a bunch of tests to try to figure out whether or not the chest pain is from your pancreas, indigestion, your heart, your lung, and all of those things can, you know, four different organ systems could be contributing to chest pain. And depending upon what is underneath the symptom, there will be a treatment. Now, unfortunately, psychiatry for the longest time could not really look at the underlying physiology because the brain's a really hard thing to look at. And we didn't have methods to look at the physiology underneath the symptoms. So we started out with this descriptive approach, which is what the DSM does, just the way you described it perfectly. Now, over time, what we've recognized is that you can have, for example, an attention problem that is because, you know, you've got one system in your brain related to attention that's genetically different, and so you'll have a harder time focusing. But you also may have an attention issue because you are in a persistent state of fear and you're developing what we call hypervigilance, that you hear the tiniest little noise, will disengage from your current task and focus on that unknown stimulus. And so the inability of our field to really look at what's underneath the symptom has led kind of to this, for lack of a better word, it's a little bit of a trap. So what we've tried to do is disengage from using that, the DSM labeling model, and be very descriptive. And so we basically try to create sort of a working model of an individual's brain by looking at a variety of symptoms and functional capabilities that the individual has, which we know are connected to certain parts of the brain. So for example, if we want to know a little bit about the top part of the brain, the cortex, we look at somebody's speech and language. And if the speech and language is normal and appropriate, we go, wow, well, that part of the cortex appears to be normal. And then we look at how well they do future planning and how well they contain their impulsivity. And so we can look at functions that help us create, basically reconstruct how the cortex is organized. And then we can do that for other areas of the brain. So if we want to know about somebody's brainstem, we look at things like, what's their resting heart rate? Do they have normal extraocular eye movements, which we know are controlled by systems that originate in the brainstem? So there are things that we can do that don't involve invasive imagery or invasive techniques, but we look at the different brain-related functions and then recreate sort of a picture of that person's brain. And so we will be able to say, hey, this kid's 10 years old, but they appear to have the social skills of a six-year-old, and they've got difficulty forming and maintaining relationships. And so we know that those systems in the brain, that part of the brain appears to be undeveloped. And so we target our therapeutic work to the systems that appear to be poorly organized or undeveloped. It's a very crude way of trying to look at what's underneath the symptoms that we're seeing. So we kind of use the term, we're creating a picture, not a label.
Right. One of the illustrations of what you're talking about is a case of a lovely child. I mean, one of the things about this book is you fall in love with the different people, these children in the different stories that you're telling. And one of them was a boy whose name is Peter. He was adopted by American parents from a Russian orphanage at the age of 3. Up until that time, he'd had virtually no kind of loving contact, just getting his diapers clean, getting fed, but not getting that love and not learning to walk and all those things. And so his parents were faced with this challenge of one day, and they were wonderful parents, but you know, one day he'd act like a 1-year-old and 5 minutes later he'd be acting like a 7-year-old and so on. And for the parents to adapt to that, they had to basically meet him where he was at that age that he was at any given moment.
Yeah, and this is one of the major challenges of parenting children who have these developmental backgrounds that are complex, that may involve some aspects of neglect, some aspects of trauma. So you'll have, for example, as you very nicely articulated, you could have an 8-year-old boy who, when he feels safe and regulated, is able to interact with peers and parents, kind of like he's 8. But if he gets frustrated, and these kids, because of the changes in the stress response system that I mentioned earlier, they become what we would call sensitized. So the tiniest little frustration can make this 8-year-old acting boy, within literally 30 seconds, start acting like he's having the terrible 2s. And, you know, a frustrated 8-year-old might sort of like walk away from a task, but a frustrated 8-year-old who has that sensitized system and regresses to that terrible 2 stage will literally have a meltdown, will break all of his Legos, will throw them all around, will scream. And as the adults try to stop him from acting that way, to regress even more. And so it's extremely challenging and confusing for families when they have kids like this, because they'll say to themselves, well, he knew better, because when I was sitting with him and talking with him about what's right and what's wrong, he knows that he's supposed to do A, B, and C, but he did Z. And because he did Z, he did that on purpose because he knows what's right. But what they're not appreciating is that when people start to have these meltdowns, the first thing that gets shut down is the top part of your brain, which is your cortex. And that's the part of your brain that has all your thinking capabilities. So in the midst of a meltdown, these children are not going to remember anything that you sort of talked with them about when they were calm. They're not going to remember all the strategies you talked through that might work the next time they get frustrated. They're just going to be pure meltdown mode. And then, of course, what's equally confusing to the adults is once the child calms down, gets a little space, comes back, and they'll walk right back and want to interact with you, and you want to hold them responsible for their behaviors, and they'll act like, what are you talking about? They literally don't remember some of the things that they did when they were having that meltdown. And again, these loops of confusion and misunderstanding lead to secondary and tertiary problems, both in school and in homes. And so kids like this, if they haven't been adopted and you're fostering a child like this, it's not unusual for a foster parent to basically go, I can't do this anymore, and they have to move to some other place. And so some of the more challenging kids end up getting 6, 10, 15 placements because they're completely misunderstood, and it leads to this cascade of problems.
And one of the things that you talk about is that when a child has grown up in chaos, they recreate that chaos when they're put in a loving and stable environment, because that familiarity, I mean, at least it's familiar, and the foster parents don't necessarily understand that.
Yeah, exactly. And it's one of the interesting characteristics of all human beings, is that we prefer the familiar even to the comfortable, right? If you think back on people you know, maybe in your family, maybe friends, sometimes they'll do things and you're like, why in the world did you do that? Then you realize, you know what? They feel more comfortable when they're in this mode that's familiar. We all do it. We all seek familiarity.
What's adaptive about that? I mean, we supposedly have this brain that is so adaptable to new situations and we seek out things that are healing, and yet we go into those old patterns.
Well, that's the interesting thing, is it probably isn't adaptive in many cases. It's funny, I talk about this all the time when I'm trying to help adults understand how hard it is to be a kid. Because I don't know how many of the listeners have changed jobs. You know, you started a new job. It's hard, you know. You don't know people that well. You don't know the routines. And so all of these new things kind of make the first weeks of a new job more stressful. And then after a while, you settle in, then it gets comfortable, and you kind of, you know your own job. And you get to a certain age where that novelty to keep learning, to keep pushing, to keep sort of stretching your comfort zone, a lot of people don't want to do that anymore. You know, they kind of like things the way they are. Now think about what we do to our kids. You're in elementary school, right? First grade, all new kids, pretty much. You have to learn new stuff every day. It's not like you learn your task and then you do that task for the rest of the year, which is kind of what most of us do. You know, once you learn your job, you do your job every day.
Right.
And it's a little bit of a variation, but it's pretty much the same job. We make kids, literally, we push them out of their comfort zone every year. Brand new class, brand new teacher, new kids. And we do this relentlessly, you know, all the way through school. And I think that it's good that we do that. We're creating predictable and somewhat moderate challenges. And when the stress response system has predictable, moderate activation, it develops resilience. The ideal would be that we would do that in a way that they would become not afraid of future learning, but continue to be aware of the positive things that come with leaving your comfort zone. It may be that you decide that you're going to travel a little bit and you leave your comfort zone that way, or you're going to learn a new skill, like, you know, I want to learn the piano at 50 or whatever it is. Those things actually help your brain get stronger. They help your stress response become much more resilient. And therefore, when something unpredictable or bad happens, you're more prepared to deal with it than if you refuse to keep learning. And so this is so much related to therapeutics. The best way that we help these kids that have had traumatic experiences is give them opportunities for moderate, predictable, and controllable activations of their stress response.
Well, you liken it to weightlifting. So you start with moderate weights and you do a certain number of repetitions regularly and you get stronger and stronger. Whereas if you go into the gym and you try to lift 300 pounds, you're just going to break yourself. And that's quite analogous to what happens when a kid gets way too much stress, or anybody gets way too much stress at one time suddenly.
Exactly. That's exactly right. The interesting thing about all the work that we've done over the last, really mostly the last 15 years, is that what we've realized is that the, if you will, the weight room for the stress response is the social milieu. What I mean by that is that children who have opportunities to have lots of little positive relational interactions with people throughout the day are able to get these tiny little doses of stress activation that are healing if you need, you know, if that system needs to be healed. So the number of positive relational interactions you have over the course of a day is the best predictor of how you're going to do emotionally, socially, behaviorally, independent of how bad your developmental trauma was when you're growing up.
Well, if there's any kind of one big takeaway from your book that draws everything else together, it's the central importance of relationships, loving and affectionate relationships, positive relationships, touch. And that is the central issue in child development and brain development. And I have to say, I mean, I found the fact that this had to be discovered by science kind of shocking. I mean, it kind of exposes the material bias and the blind spots of science. But so much of what you do is about building, and not even necessarily the therapeutic relationship, although that's important, but the little kind of child-controlled 5-minute interactions here and there with safe adults and safe peers.
Exactly. And as it turns out, and not a lot of my mental health peers are going to love this comment, but the majority of therapeutic interactions that help individuals who've had trauma take place outside of therapy. There are these momentary interactions with people where the person feels heard, they feel safe in that interaction, they feel respected. It's not necessarily the words you say, it's the presence that you give. The most therapeutic person I ever knew was a janitor, and he had no formal training. He hardly ever spoke, but he was always available to listen and reflect back reassurance, comfort, respect. And that was a powerful, powerful therapeutic experience for all of the kids that he interacted with.
And there's a woman in your book whom you call Mama P, who was this very, I imagined her to be kind of heavy set, very strong, extremely maternal, smart woman with no medical or psychological training, whose deepest instincts, and probably she was, you imagine, a very well-loved person herself, she was able to heal people in a way that had to do just simply with instinctively knowing how to hold them and rock them and touch them and talk to them.
Exactly. Exactly. And see, that's the amazing thing about all of this work. And you kind of touched on it earlier. These things about the importance of touch and connection and people and all of, that's always been part of the collective wisdom of traditional peoples. People have always kind of known this. And Western medicine has kind of invented itself away from these very powerful but very kind of obvious points.
Right.
The irony is, I mean, I have to laugh sometimes because there'll be people who will talk about how important it is to touch a baby and how holding a child and soothing them is therapeutically positive. And then you get these folks that are like, well, what's the evidence? You're like, well, geez.
Right.
Okay. Like, well, what's the evidence that 45 minutes once a week is any different than 1 minute once a week? Have you done studies on that? And they haven't. And so the interesting thing is about the people who are in power, who practice a certain way, 85% of what they do has no evidence base. But whenever they're faced with any new innovation, including an obvious observation, they'll challenge it with saying, oh, where's the evidence?
Well, also, you'd be abusing a lot of children if you took a control group and didn't touch them. I mean, then you'd have a kid like Peter from the Russian orphanage.
Well, and the irony is that was done. You know, Frederick the Great, who was one, you know, was curious. There was a big debate that was taking place at the time. The debate was, what's the natural language of God? Is it Arabic? Is it Hebrew? Is it Latin? He said, well, I'm going to do an experiment. I'm going to prove what the natural language of God is. So he basically, because he was the emperor, he took a bunch of newborn babies and he raised them in environments where they were not spoken to, no language at all. And guess what they spoke? Nothing.
Right.
They never learned language. And because he neglected them so profoundly early on, they had a hard time developing language as they got older. So, you know, these experiments have been done. Unfortunately, they're cruel, as you said. They're inhumane experiments of humanity. But the idea that we have to do double-blind, randomly controlled trials for every aspect of what we do is absurd. We don't have enough money to do that. You know, you take the entire budget of the NIH and you'd probably just be able to do a handful of controlled trials in some of these complex areas.
Well, it also reminds one of the reality that medicine and all the sciences, you know, they are part science, part art. And as I was reading it, I mean, this book is written, The Boy Who Was Raised as a Dog, very much in the first person, and you are going kind of on a journey of discovery that we go through with you. And one of the things that's so striking is that you clearly, I mean, this is my reading of it, but you were drawn to this work because you had kind of an instinctive and intuitive feeling about kids and were good with kids and knew how to kind of look at them and specifically and precisely not be in the kind of like objective scientist mode, but be relating as one human being to another. And that paradoxically perhaps or not, leads to scientific insight.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. I was actually a parent before I, you know, I mean, really in the middle of medical school. So by the time I was doing this kind of advanced clinical training, I had several kids and I knew a lot about kids and I liked kids. And so some of the stuff I was being taught, I was like, wait a minute, that's not right. You know,
it's like, right.
That doesn't make sense. You know, or stuff just like the idea that when you're working with a child who's in your office because they have had some horrible thing happen to them, that you shouldn't touch them. Like, 3-year-old kids are tactile. I mean, that's what they do. They play, they wrestle, they, you know, you can obviously have, you know, you have to do this in an appropriate way, but it's not inappropriate for a kid to get a hug from an adult when they want reassurance. And it just, you know, there's so many aspects of the way we practice with children that are carryovers of adult practice. And so it is, you know, it would be not, a, you know, it's very rarely appropriate to give a hug to a patient necessarily if they're an adult. But if you have a 2.5-year-old kid and they crawl into your lap, there's nothing wrong with giving them a hug and then redirecting them back out to let's play this.
Well, and it's telling that one of the things that's going on in the at the border with these children in prison camps is that they're not allowed to hug their own siblings or anybody else.
That is such absurd stuff. And the idea is, and this has happened in a lot of places, it's sort of a weird backlash to fears about sexual exploitation or teachers getting in trouble for touching kids and false allegations and all that kind of stuff. So their solution is completely developmentally uninformed. It's like, no touching. Like, it's like, well, that's absurd. And not only absurd, it's destructive. I mean, literally physical proximity and touch for the developing child is crucial in the expression of a variety of neuroendocrine systems. It's right. Important for their brain development, for their body development. And it for us to not do that is just terrible. It's abusive.
Well, and one of the most chilling cases in the book was this cold-hearted teenager, criminal, violent child, young man named Leon, who was a sociopath. And it turns out he'd been utterly neglected as an infant by a mother who herself was mentally disabled and didn't have the support systems she needed. I mean, with her first child, she did because there was an extended family, but then they moved and she did. And so this young person turned into a human being with no empathy. And it just, I mean, you start thinking, first of all, I mean, there are two big questions that come to mind. One is there any treatment when that person is grown for that condition? And is this true of all sociopaths? I mean, the Jeffrey Dahmers and the Ted Bundys, were they all like neglected in ways like this?
Well, both of those are really great questions. And I honestly don't have an answer for either one necessarily. I have some thoughts and some experience in both areas. But so let me just start with the first one, that we actually have worked with a lot of kids that had significant early neglect and who have inability to show normal social engagement, and they would be called reactive attachment disorder. Now, what we found is that, you know, these kids may be 8, 10, 12, you can help them. And what you do is you basically sort of get this roadmap from the way we create this brain map that tells us where they are developmentally. And then you start to create a set of reparative experiences that meet the needs of those developing systems that didn't get what they needed at the time. And so with appropriate forms, appropriate dosing and spacing of healthy touch and relational presence, these kids can develop better social skills, a better capacity to connect. They can demonstrate empathy and so forth. So we know that you can do that. Now, as you get older, it takes more repetitions and it takes more time. And part of the problem we have right now is that many of the kids that have those problems end up in settings like a juvenile justice setting where the ability to create the density of relational opportunity to allow them to begin to change is absent. If you look at the relational interactions that these kids have in those settings, number one, there's a poverty of relationships. And number two, the vast majority of relationships are around power and dominance and threat. And they're not really the kinds of nurturing interactions that these individuals would need to have those systems change. So in some ways, our systems that are designed to intervene with those individuals are set up to prevent the kinds of therapeutic change that would be required to help them. Now, we do have some instances of adults, young adults, who got into environments where there was a density of relational interactions and there wasn't significant improvement. But it takes time, and it takes unconditional presence and unconditional love. A couple examples involved elders in a indigenous community taking some of these sort of antisocial kids into their home, basically, and embracing them with unconditional regard and lots of relational opportunities, as opposed to putting them in a cell where they would sit, 24 hours a day and have 1 hour of contact with a bunch of other inmates while they walked around the inside of a prison.
Right. And whether it's, inmates in a prison, or you give another example of toddlers with developmental problems, you put a bunch of toddlers who are screwed up together and they reinforce each other's difficulties, whereas you really need to surround the child with healthy children. And there's a beautiful example of that. Again, going back to, I don't know why I keep going to this story, Peter, the kid from the Russian orphanage, you did this really beautiful thing, which is went and talked to his first grade classroom about the brain and about Peter's brain in particular. What happened? Tell us that story.
Well, Peter had spent the first years of his life in a very sterile institutional setting. Probably the majority of the time was in a crib by himself. He could see and maybe touch a few people that were in cribs next to him, other kids. But it was really an emotionally depriving environment. And when he was adopted, the family didn't understand that much about the impact of this stuff, but he made some progress and then, developed language, and he was coming along developmentally, but then he went to school. And because he was kind of odd socially, the kids were kind of afraid of him, didn't really know what to make of him, and it led to more social isolation and so forth. And so what we did was we went in and, with his permission and with the parents' permission, talked to the school about, where he came from and how the brain works and how the brain develops, and that he came from a background that was different than theirs, and that's why he has trouble sometimes with some things, but that he's been doing really well, and that what really helps him is when people are nice to him and show him how to do things and all kinds of other stuff. And so once we explained this to these kids, they became very protective of him. They included him in their activities and they invited him to birthday parties and all the things where he'd been excluded, he was embraced and kind of became like sort of the class, I don't want to use the term mascot, it's the wrong word, but it's sort of like the class hero. And over the years, their presence and their relational supports helped him get better and heal. And a lot of the areas where he had deficits, he started to catch up. And so by the time he was further along in school, he was popular and he was elected like the class president at one point. And so here's the situation where making this child sort of a known quantity and understanding why he's this way, what happened to him that he acted this way, led to these kids, the natural tendency to be empathic and caring and embracing sort of kicked in. And people are good at heart by and large. And when we aren't good, it's because of fear or misunderstanding usually. And so when you can take some of that away, you can really increase the goodness that can emerge in a situation like that.
Well, and I think that story is so illustrative because when the kid was in kindergarten, his peers rejected him because of that misunderstanding. And so that kind of natural empathy occurs in the context where there's understanding.
Yeah. Honestly, I think that that's a big part of what's playing out in our modern political arena is a lot of fear. Fear and misunderstanding leads to more primitive thinking, which leads to more primitive behavior, which leads to more fear, which leads to more primitive behavior. And we've seen this, you know, since I was, there was nothing like this when I was growing up. I mean, there were, I'm sure that, I know there was racism, and there were all kinds of other bad things, but sort of this huge polarization in our population about some of these topics is so disheartening. And I think so much of it is about misunderstanding and fear. The inability to get to sort of learn how to respect people and spend time with people and understand them. And, you know, once we spend more time with people who are different from us, the more we realize that those differences are pretty minor. And actually, the differences are something to celebrate because they bring sort of novelty and diversity to our life experience, which it just is enriching in the end.
This, the work that you're doing, and it's a lot of groundbreaking work in terms of how we understand trauma, how we treat trauma, how we understand the brain, how we understand relationship. This work is, it's kind of bringing into being some new paradigms, or as we were talking about, some new paradigms based on really old understandings that are kind of intuitive to us, but also some real new scientific knowledge about the brain and so on. Is this work diffusing out into education, into parenting, and in fact, into the mental health system itself?
Yeah, you know, we've actually had a remarkably positive set of experiences trying to roll this out into educational settings and caregiving settings on top of the traditional mental health and medical environments. So right now, we have like 26 different countries that are using this approach in their mental health, child welfare, and educational systems. We have, for example, in the state of Arizona, there's sort of statewide initiatives to bring these concepts into schools and paired with statewide initiative to bring some of these concepts into the mental health system. And so we've seen a lot of uptake. We've seen a lot of really positive outcomes, at, particularly in schools that were struggling. And so we're cautiously optimistic that the more you learn about these things, the more you learn about how the brain changes, about how fear impacts the way we think and behave, the more we learn about how to help regulate people who have these fear-related and trauma-related changes, the more we can improve outcomes. And so we're cautiously optimistic, and we're seeing not just our work, but there are many other people who are in mental health and child welfare and education who are recognizing the importance of these concepts and integrating different aspects of this work into what they do. And so I feel like, you know, this is part of really a broader movement to make our culture more developmentally sensitive, more trauma-informed and trauma-aware. And I think in the long run, as people learn these things and then act on them, we're going to see significant changes in a lot of areas that these kids and these families have to deal with.
Do you think this all goes to the root of why there's so very much child abuse and neglect in the first place? I mean, we did evolve from primates who, by and large, don't do that kind of thing. And most people in most societies don't do that kind of thing. And yet we have this, I mean, I don't know if the word epidemic is appropriate, but we have this kind of madness that it's hard to fully, I mean, I don't fully understand.
You know, believe me, if I understood it better, I might be able to be part of making some changes. There's a couple things that I think are at play that we don't talk about very much in our culture. And one of them is our culture. You know, right. As we've invented sort of the way we live in the West, we valued individual rights a lot, which I think is great. But I think that one of the things that's happened is that the human living group has gotten smaller and smaller and smaller. And so I think as a population, we're much more fragmented and isolated. One of the things that we know about child abuse and neglect is that the more there is social isolation, the more there is a rise in abuse and neglect. You know, it's interesting. It used to be almost unheard of. And I mean, and by this, I mean multiple decades ago. But right now, there are parts of the U.S. where 60% of the population lives alone. So raising children is extremely challenging. And in the sort of the natural condition where we lived in sort of multi-family, multi-generational groups, if you had a baby, you had aunties and grandmas and older cousins and older siblings all around, and there was a distribution of the caregiving burden. Not you know, the parents were the parents, but there's a lot that goes on with caregiving. So the ratio used to be 4-1. 4 developmentally more mature adults for every child under the age of 6. And now it's not unusual to have, even in a 2-parent home, if the parents work, they'll send the children off to settings where the ratio is 1 adult and 5 kids, 1 adult and 20 kids. And so we've completely diluted this kind of relational matrix that is required for optimal child rearing. And so if you have a stay-at-home mom and you got a couple of kids and you don't have any supports, it's exhausting, it's frustrating, and you can definitely see where there's a rise in sort of exhaustion and frustration-related interactions with the child, some of which could even reach the threshold of abuse and neglect. And then you fold into that issues of substance use and dependence, because that's really a major factor in at least half of the cases of abuse and neglect. A lot of times parents are taking that to deal with their own anxiety, their own history of trauma, their own inability to cope with their depression. And so they're seeking escape, regulation, reward in a drug because they've got relational poverty in their own life. And so all of these things are kind of converging to create really a miserable set of circumstances for young kids, particularly young kids in families that are in poverty. It's just very, very hard to raise kids, period. But when you don't have relational resources and you don't have economic resources, it's much harder.
To end on a more positive note, a lot of the stories in this book are ones that maybe had a good outcome. I mean, the child who was raised as a dog ended up having, you know, making huge strides very quickly once he was gotten out of this essentially kennel. Do you follow up with these people? I mean, we're hearing, of course, only a fraction of the stories of the kids that you've dealt with, but do you follow up and are you finding that they are, with the right treatment, able to thrive?
You know, it's interesting. A lot of, just because of the fragmentary nature of our mental health systems, a lot of the children that we work with are what we would call lost to follow-up. You know, they go back into a system where we aren't able to track them. But a lot of the kids now, particularly since we have newer, sort of easier methods, we are finding that the outcomes are much better with the kids that have had the opportunity to get these developmentally appropriate interventions. You know, it's not all perfect. It's not all great stories, but there's a lot of them. And when we do the research on it, the outcomes are far superior to the groups of kids that don't get these kinds of interventions. So we're cautiously optimistic that if you understand the developmental history of a child and you put together a developmentally attuned intervention approach, that the outcomes will be good.
Dr. Bruce Perry, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
And once again, Dr. Bruce Perry will be here in Santa Fe in September for an early childhood symposium at Santa Fe Community College, co-sponsored by Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation. You can find out more at sfcc.edu/ecconference. And I'll link to that at radiocafe.org.
Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Growing local teachers and cultivating educational leadership, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. The Radio Cafe and the Santa Fe New Mexican thank the Lanl Foundation for their support. You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.